Yes, sir, I can go ahead. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm testifying today as an individual concerned with some of the key policy issues involved in taxation of oil and gas by the state of Alaska. Much of Alaska's future depends upon the legislature's and the governor's ability and willingness to face these issues and act accordingly. What you do may well determine whether Alaska gets raped and ripped off once more, or whether the state and its citizens participate in the benefits that come from resources development. In approaching this whole subject, I start with the belief that the state has the power, the right, and the justification to levy taxes on oil and gas to benefit and meet the needs of the people of Alaska now and in the future. And to me, this means that the state should go after the maximum possible oil revenue share for Alaska. I primarily want to deal with these issues by using as a point of departure the arguments that have been raised by the oil industry and their representatives in the adamant opposition to any changes and increases in taxation. Much nonsense has been bantered about a fair deal principle of taxation. Mostly we've been fed a phony line and a bunch of gibberish. We've been told that oil companies bought leases with the understanding that tax rules wouldn't be changed in the future. That's pure nonsense, and every oil executive knows that. Oil companies, in fact, made allowances for future tax levels significantly higher than those prevailing at the time, which were about 1 or 2 cents a barrel. The only compact pertained to lease terms. As a sovereign state, Alaska could change its tax laws every year if it wished. And speaking of lease terms, a number of studies and innumerable consultants have shown that if anyone didn't get a fair deal from Prudhoe Bay oil leasing, it was the Alaska public. Several independent studies have concluded that the state should have received billions of dollars in 1969 rather than the paltry $900 million. From that standpoint, it would only be appropriate to now square the deal. Rather than talking about any concept of fair deal, we should be concerned about fair value. In the case of oil and gas, we're dealing with a common property, with community resources that belong to this generation and to Alaskans in the future. No fixed formula really gets at the question of what is a fair payment to the people of Alaska. We've long struggled to arrive at a point where the willing buyer meets the willing seller. We still need to keep trying, for I greatly doubt that our existing tax structure is at that magic point. In working toward establishing a fair value of Alaska resources, we must keep moving toward the point at which we have tangible evidence that it makes a difference, that the industry is walking away. Only at that point do we know that we are at a critical point. Until we reach it, we're giving away resources or values that belong out to Alaskans of the present and the future. And when we do reach that tipping point, we can then decide how far and in what direction to make further adjustments. A few more quick arguments that are often made against changes, such as oil taxation in Alaska is equal to or higher than any other state. Now I understand we're not necessarily the highest. But that, in any case, proves nothing to me. It may simply be that most other states, if not all other states, are taxing the oil industry too low. Just the other day, I read an article in The Economist about oil taxation in Texas, and it was clear that that particular state has had a traditional policy of keeping oil prices low. I'm sure that goes for every other oil-producing state, but that is where the oil lobbies are located in force, and their representatives exercise the greatest influence, just as they're trying to in Alaska. It seems to me that if comparisons are made, they should be with OPEC and other nations. It is there that you will find situations comparable to ours, where a sovereign government is out to extract maximum benefit from oil development without killing off the industry. Another slogan we've heard is that you should not single out the oil industry. Well, every state and nation singles out the major industry, the concentrations of wealth, those most capable of paying. It was because the territory of Alaska was unable to effectively tax the Guggenheims and the salmon industry that those were not singled out when they should have been. And because of that, Alaska and its people have been worse off ever since. Then we have the statement that oil development pays for itself. Yes, but not always. It's pretty well true that oil found on state lands will pay for itself. But state lands account for only 1/10 of the estimated speculative recoverable oil and gas resources in Alaska. Federal offshore resources account for 2/3 of the total projected for oil and gas. And as of now, their development would be a pure net liability to the state. Some of our current institute analyses show that federal OCS leasing will generate a cost of $220 million to the state in 1990. And even this projection is conservative, for it is predicated on two precarious assumptions. First, that states will receive federal grants equivalent to 10% of federal OCS revenues. And secondly, that the state is able to levy income taxes on OCS workers regardless of where they live. Without these two assumptions being realized, the 1990 cost to the state would exceed the $200 million by another $50 to $100 million. In general, it must be recognized that oil development is responsible directly and indirectly for population growth, social problems, unemployment as well as employment, community facility needs, and many other things that in the end do result in higher state expenditures. We've also heard many arguments recently along the lines such as the oil industry should be encouraged rather than discouraged. If the state raises taxes, the industry will, and so on. You know the rest. I agree that we should encourage whatever development will benefit Alaska, but we should not encourage development if it's at the expense of Alaskans. Above all, we must make sure that we don't give away potential benefits where we get nothing in return. And this can readily happen under two circumstances. First, we may simply tax too low to make any difference. 20 years ago, Alaska had a severance tax of 1%. When proposals came before the legislature to double the tax to 2%, screams went up from the oil industry and its friends that we will discourage future exploration and development in Alaska. And when the next time around came for tax increase proposals, we heard the same threat. And of course, we know nothing happened then. It didn't go away. And just as we hear them now from some of the same people. No one wants to pay taxes, and I, for one, wish that I could threaten IRS tomorrow that I'll take my marbles and go away to Canada, and that would make any difference, but I don't think they would listen to me, and I hope we have the same attitude. But I don't blame the oil industry for using every argument in the book, but our past experience, as well as our common sense, tells us that we shouldn't necessarily accept all the arguments, and, as they might say in the industry, leave any potential tax monies on the table, especially when we have no commitments whatsoever from the industry that we'll get anything from them in return for a low tax rate. Secondly, I believe that we better have a good idea of what it is that we're being asked to encourage and for what purpose we're to keep our taxes lower. I just have a very strong hunch that what we will do will have little effect on whether there was any additional major oil discoveries in Alaska. This is particularly so because most projected reserves, as I mentioned, are in federal lands, both offshore and onshore. In fact, there's no guarantee whatsoever that any more giant fields will be found. Alaska's energy nest egg may be far less than initially surmised. Just last week, we were advised that Part 4 may be a bust. No end of state inducement will bring discoveries if there's no oil to be discovered. It is my conviction that the state should adopt policies and strategies premised on Prudhoe Bay being a one-time event. That means we must secure Alaska's future on the basis of Prudhoe without maintaining false hopes for further bonanzas. If some other giant fields are discovered, that would be fine, but at least we will not have given away what may be a chance of a lifetime to meet Alaska's real needs. An oil lobby trying to make a totally different point was recently quoted as saying, when Prudhoe Bay production begins to decline in 20 years, what will the state look for in the way of revenues if there have not been other fields discovered and economic endeavors would encourage economic viability in the state? That is exactly my question and my point. Economic viability will come from making the best of our present opportunities, which to me above all means taxing Prudhoe to build up the permanent fund and otherwise build Alaska's base. Economic viability will not come through giving money to the oil industry in the form of lower taxes. And future revenues will also be available only if we use what may be a one-time opportunity to build a basis for an adequate income stream in the future. Our present tax structure won't make this possible. Let me run through a quick projection of what kind of a revenue situation we might be facing. Assume for the moment that there are no more major fields brought in, and by the year 2000 or somewhere around that time, oil and resultant revenues decline or cease. Let's further assume that by severe holding down of state expenditures, we've managed, without resorting to tax increases, to accumulate a fund balance of $20 billion, a rather generous assumption. That $20 billion could function as an annuity to help cover future state expenditures after that year 2000. But that would be far from enough to sustain even the present comparative level of spending. In fact, we would be about 25% short of meeting current level funding requirements, even with that colossal amount of savings. Thus, if we consider the $20 million in annuities, it would, at 7%, bring an income of about $2,000 per capita, assuming again conservatively a year 2000 population of 600,000. To get some feel for what that means, you have to deflate that to 1970. Using an inflation rate of 5%, which is certainly lower than what we've seen recently, we come up with a 1977 value of $650 per capita of this future $20 billion investment. What this means is that our oil-produced savings of $650, together with non-petroleum revenues, which run now at $900, would in effect produce a total income equivalent to $1,550 per capita in 1977. Compare that to per capita expenditures of roughly $2,000 now, and you see that we have a significant revenue gap. And this, in effect, is what Alaska will face when petroleum revenues run out in the future, be it year 2000 or some other time, unless we think in terms of taxing and saving, not just in terms of what is fair today, but taking into account the revenue needs of the future. To deal with the situation, we must start thinking and making revenue expenditure projections, not just to 1985, but to year 2000 and beyond. What looks like a massive surplus that we may be building up from frugal revenues may be totally inadequate to sustain the state in the long run. Only an adequate saving program based on greatly increased revenues will provide for Alaska's future at the time when the oil industry may be a figment of the past. If we raise our taxes to adequate levels now, we can always lower them if we find a need for incentives or additional fields are brought in. But there is no indication now that incentives are needed or the higher taxes will scare the industry away, especially since, again, most projected activities will take place in areas where the state will receive few benefits. Let's look at another set of arguments used against raising petroleum taxes and revenues. Oil and gas taxes, and I quote, will generate income in excess of state needs. They're not justified by state needs, and so on. We've heard this time and again. That, of course, is utter nonsense, not only in the long run, as I've just discussed, but also in terms of Alaska's present needs. For the past several years, both under the Egan and Hammond administrations, per capita state expenditures have, in terms of real dollars, been kept at an effectively static level. If anything, they've gone down slightly. Department of Revenue expenditure projections actually appear to show a decline of per capita spending in the years to come to 1985. However, this holding down of state spending in no way says that the state and its people have no need, that there is no need for further income. Let's take a look at rural Alaska for one example, And here the North Slope Borough starts providing us with an initial measure of unmet needs. While the total North Slope population is somewhere in excess of 10,000, by the time you discount that by oil-related employees at Prudhoe and elsewhere, and by people on federal installations, you come down to about 4,000 residents of the borough who are actually served by the borough. During the last fiscal year, the borough spent more than $14 million on non-capital expenditures, or about $3,500 per permanent resident. Half of this amount was raised through local taxes, essentially property taxes, levied on the oil industry. This money is being spent for a variety of local services, everything from education to street maintenance to utilities and law enforcement, zoning, and cultural preservation. In essence, the North Slope Borough is spending the equivalent of $1,750 per capita in rural regions for needs that are not being met by the state or anyone else in other regions than the North Slope Borough. I believe that it is quite fair to assume that the needs of the rest of rural Alaska are at least as great as those on the North Slope. If we assume that, we come up with an annual unmet expenditure need of $180 million, and that's for rural Alaska alone. Let's take a similar look at capital projects. The North Slope Borough currently has a total of $56 million in authorized bonds for capital improvements, schools, roads, power, heating plants, water, sewer, housing, and other projects. Assuming, once more, that similar needs exist throughout the rest of rural Alaska, the resultant need for capital improvements in rural areas is about $15 billion, and that's assuming that the North Slope is currently about to fully meet the needs of its people. I have a hunch that the total figure would be significantly higher. It's obviously ridiculous to even suggest that greater income is not justified by lack of existing needs. Just because the state is currently not doing much to meet these needs doesn't mean that such needs don't exist. I've so far mentioned only rural areas. What about cities? Are there no unmet needs there? I'm sure they run into many, many billions of dollars. How about our transportation system in the state? Is there no need for more and better roads, better airports, docks and harbors, ferry system extensions? Are there no more educational needs, health needs, law enforcement, cultural enrichment needs? Is there no need for expanded local government revenue sharing or for better communication? No one can tell me there are no state needs that would justify more state income, even if there were a valid issue for the oil industry to even argue. I'm sure you can think of many projects that could be built from current revenues if we only had more income. Just to give you one example, the construction of a new state capital, assuming we move it, should not really require bonding, but using only a small part of increased revenue, say $20 to $30 million a year. We could build a new capital in a pay-as-we-go basis. One last point. In approving the establishment of a permanent fund, Alaska's voters accepted the philosophy of using non-renewable resources to help underwrite Alaska's future. There are two ways of getting the most out of the state's non-renewable resources. One, obtain maximum revenue from the extraction of such resources, or two, leave the resources in the ground. The value of resources not produced has in recent years appreciated much faster than any revenues derived from invested resources income. In the case of oil, the value tripled over the past few years. Thus, the second option is not as preposterous as it may seem at first. We are, however, in an era when a nation faces a serious energy resource deficiency. Therefore, although it might actually be in the state's economic interest to go slow in oil development and conserve the resource in the ground, the national interest demands that we facilitate petroleum production. But such production in the national interest should not be at the expense of Alaska's future. And the only way we can assure that is by taking a full share of resources value through taxation and related means. In conclusion, Let me just say that I believe it is in the public interest to increase taxes on oil and gas at this time. If the situation changes in the future, if more discoveries are made, the state can reevaluate its revenue situation. But we will never have a chance to make up for any income foregone as a result of not taking too hard, as a result of taking too hard. Industry arguments that really don't have any validity. Thank you. That's right, there were competitive bids. No, there's nothing we can do about it except to make up for it. Very often when you have competitive bids, you don't necessarily realize the full value of the product that is being sold. And the argument here is that the full value was not realized. Well, there were some who argued that at the time, including a very interesting paper that was prepared by Greg Erickson, who is research director for the Alaska Legislature now. Thank you.
Sorry, we can certainly do it one at a time. This essentially is what we were going to do. Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate your providing the opportunity. My name is Byron Holland, and I'm a tax counsel with San Juan Company, California. I understand that you would like to have a little background of the witnesses in very slightly. I've been a tax attorney with Peridot for about 24 years, and fundamentally have been in the domestic tax open end, and have been stationed in New Orleans and Denver and now in the San Francisco office. This is more or less my notes. I do have a handout. And what I would like to do at this time is to, as part of my testimony, present you with a series of short, concise papers developed by our committee. I'm not going to, of course, take all of your time to go through that, those numbers of papers, but I would like to take this opportunity to more or less touch on the highlights in the background of the papers, if I may. Thank you. I'm chairman also of the Alaska Oil and Gas Tax Committee, and in this capacity, I'm speaking today. Our committee, with the help of others, have put these papers together, these papers contain information and analyses relative to petroleum taxation in Alaska, considered to us to be what we think is helpful in determining future Alaska oil tax policy. The contributors have sought to make these papers concise and accurate, stripped to the best of our ability of the technical complexities which necessarily are inherent in these various oil tax studies that have been conducted and the resultant legislative proposals. It had been hoped that this approach, in its simplified brevity, would be of assistance to the members of your committee in decisions to be made on future taxation of oil and gas in Alaska. Then let me identify the papers and briefly describe their content. Part one depicts the petroleum industry's contribution to Alaska's total government revenues during the most recently completed fiscal year, 1976, and its contribution projected over the year for the year 1981. In 1976, before the commencement of the crude oil based production, our industry paid over one half of all the revenue collected by the state. In 1981, it's projected that petroleum will account for 79% of the total revenue, assuming no change in the existing tax laws and rates. We believe that this is one confirmation of our industry's contribution to the state government, probably unequaled anywhere in the nation. It certainly could be considered as a major factor in identifying whether the petroleum industry is and will be paying its fair share of taxes to Alaska. Part two of the papers deals with the Alaska Oil and Gas Production Tax, describing how it works, including the interplay of the percentage of wellhead value rate and the alternate cent per barrel floor, or the minimum tax rate. This latter floor, used in almost all cases in Cook Inlet production, has produced an average rate of approximately 8%, representing an eightfold increase.
Whose duty it is to play fair with its citizens, whether they're the corporate citizens or individuals. The second main point of HB 322 deals with deleting the sales factor and substituting the extraction factor. Before plunging into this subject, I believe it would be helpful to give the committee some background about the traditional three-factor formula which utilizes property, payroll, and sales. Where it came from, why it is used today by most states which tax corporate income. Another reason why this will be helpful is that Professors Diefman and Ainsworth gave their testimony recommending a change strictly on the basis that its use will apportion more income and therefore provide more tax. However, the matter is not quite as simple as the professors have indicated. When states began taxing corporate income over 50 years ago, there were various formulas used to divide the income. Because there were different formulas, it wasn't very long before disputes arose between states and taxpayers, usually involving the question of whether the state was reaching for too much of the taxpayer's income. It is very important to bear in mind all the way through the discussion of this subject that a state can constitutionally tax only that income of the taxpayer which is derived from within the state's borders. Thus, the search has always been to find a formula which gives both the taxpayer and the state fair treatment. But as to the taxpayer who operates in more than one state, the problem has also been to utilize a method of dividing income which does not subject the taxpayer to multiple taxation. It's not difficult to see how multiple taxation can occur. Suppose X company operates in states A, B, and C, each of which has the same standard three-factor formula of property, payroll, and sales, and each of the states has just an 8% income tax rate. It would be very rare if X company had exactly the same mixture of property, payroll, and sales in each state. However, when each of the three states apply their tax laws and divide the income under their uniform formulas, X's total tax to all three states will be no more than 8% of its total income. But let's vary the example just slightly and assume that in state A, X company has a heavy concentration of property and payroll, but not many sales. And that state A decides to delete its sales factor and have only a two-factor formula. In such a case, state A will apportion to itself a greater amount of X's income, but the apportionment to states B and C will remain the same. The result will be that an amount greater than X's total income will be apportioned in the aggregate to all three states, and X will have been subjected to multiple taxation because state A broke the uniformity. The foregoing is a simplified example, but nevertheless demonstrates how multiple taxation can result. As noted earlier, disputes over income taxation existed for decades, and it was not until 1957 when the Commissioners on Uniform Laws, in conjunction with the tax section of the American Bar Association and many other interested parties, finally wrote a model law known as the Uniform Division of Income for Tax Purposes Act, commonly known in the trade as UDIPPA, in the hope that the states would adopt it and thus put an end to the chaotic condition that has existed. The apportionment formula settled upon utilized property, payroll, and destination sales. Underlying this three-factor theory of apportionment is the concept that the employment of capital in the form of property, labor as reflected in payroll and ultimate sales to generate the sustaining revenues for the business are all vital factors to be given equal weight in determining income. Thus, the theory recognizes that in a true economic sense, some part of the taxable income is earned at every stage in the business process. To date, about half the states, including Alaska, have adopted the Uniform Division Act, the Tax Purposes Act, and all but two states which impose an income tax use the three-factor formula utilizing property, payroll, and sales. The model law only deals with apportionment of income and doesn't contain provisions setting forth rules or procedures whereby a state cooperates with other states to administer this taxation on some kind of joint basis. In an effort to promote uniformity of tax rules and cooperation, a number of states formed what's now called the Multi-State Tax Compact. However, a state which adopts the compact also adopts the three-factor division of income formula based on the UDIPSA model law. Alaska adopted the compact in 1970, but it followed the model law formula before 1970. Hence, states which have adopted the compact and states which simply follow the model law rules have compatible laws. With this background, let me turn to the proposal to delete the sales factor and impose an extraction factor. In total? Probably more than that. But we're, on this particular bill, maybe 15 minutes or so. No, this is just on this bill here, on 222. This is the income tax bill. No, the total, just on this bill, and then they've got severance tax bill and the property tax bill. I pointed out to the chair that the Union Oil Company, who I work for, is currently the largest producer of oil and gas in the state of Alaska.
That's right.
Right.
I understand that.
We have a lot of money at stake on this, Mr. Chairman.
Well, sir, I think it all varies from you, sir. I think you've been a little more effective if you look to the testimony and the written form at the point it comes on in an hour from now. Your statement really was that it would take around 30 minutes, and here it's going to take about 2 hours. Certainly, you realize the visibility of the 30 spent off witnesses in the middle of the testimony.
Well, I guess I was led to believe, Mr. Chairman, that people wanted to know how the three-factor formula worked, how the extraction factor, some of the theories and so forth. We heard, I believe, testimony all afternoon from not too long ago from Mr. Zeeson and Mr. Ainsworth. And, you know, there's a couple of sides to the question here. It's not quite as simple as some people think.
I think you will come back tonight.
Yes, I will.
Two words. About fighting.
Does anybody have any questions? Means that part of your income is being taxed really more than once. Maybe not all of the income, but a part of it.
Well, would you play it in Dr. Gleason made a comment on provision to avoid access to double taxation?
A provision which what's the definition of multiple taxation? Where all more than where you were taxed on more than all of your income?
That's right.
Well, that's an inadequate definition. It's an improper definition because you can be multiply taxed without being taxed 100% on all of your income. That's an invalid approach. Under the present system, there's no question about it. That's what your extraction factor will do.
No. Not the utilization, the uniform utilization of a three-factor formula
when you bury
throughout the United States, it wouldn't occur, and that's the point, is that we seek uniformity, and a variance from uniformity causes one state to be dipping into another state's income, right. Simply put.
It can be done by separate accounting, by changing one of the factors, by dropping a factor out.
We have another paper I'll submit along with it that explains this very thoroughly. Could you, just a quick example, could you envisage two states, one state produces and another state doesn't produce and they buy all the production? And the one state that produces decides to use an extraction factor, so all of the income is sitting in that state. The state that doesn't have production decides to use a sales factor. And so they get virtually all the sales. Could you, with that vivid thing, this is an extreme, but could you see the double taxation in that case?
Would you be satisfied with the commission
of the states involved in the board? But there, unfortunately, are 50 states, about 40-some states. No, but that was a theoretical example to show you what we mean by double taxation.
That's why they tried to set up the multi state tax compact.
Well, according to Mr. Gleason, the current likelihood of double taxation
by a darn sight. He's been in the classroom too long.
Thank you.
Have you read? Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Roger Lang, and I am currently an employee of the Bristol Bay Native Corporation and the Alaska Corporation. In effect, one of those strange animals called a lobbyist. It's been my past history, Mr. Chairman, to also have been the president of the Alaska Federation of Natives and to have testified in matters of this scope in other arenas and in other circumstances. Since most of you weren't at the joint hearings of the Natural Resource Committee, I should like to preface my remarks with a couple of things, Mr. Chairman. One is I'm also a member of a regional corporation board of directors, which makes me one of those strange animals often accused of being in bed with oil. Mr. Chairman, at times we are not in bed with oil, at times we are oil. Currently, there is exploration being conducted on potential native-owned land in Bristol Bay, in the Arctic Slope, and in the Doyle region, to my knowledge. The exploration in Chilisa and Nana, as far as I know, has been terminated for the present and is not now existent. In other years, Mr. Chairman, we brought the best tax consultants and the best oil consultants that money could buy to testify and help us prepare a testimony. And I think that's where we got the image of, hey, you're in bed with oil, because our testimony is very like that which you have heard from other people. But now that death scheme is changing, in effect, this committee sits, and other committees of the legislature, sits as a board of equalization for those of us that are not in taxing boroughs. The property laws that you talk about, the franchise taxes, all those things are schemes that are done generally on a municipal level or a borough level, but not mostly, and with the exception of Arctic, you know, as such, I think it behooves this committee to be aware of what it's doing to its citizens as it makes this mad charge on Prudhoe Ridge. Nothing you do is without effect on the lands that we own. Nothing you do is not without effect on the production of minerals that relate to private land and private ownership, mineral development. We have different types of economics, Mr. Chairman. Our economics are such that in the matter of regionally owned timber, regionally owned minerals, either hard or soft, the fact is that our economics are much different than any corporation ever formed in America. We have a little section in our act called 7I. Briefly, it says that if I cut a tree down and get a dollar for it, and it's a regionally owned tree, I get to save $0.30 to that tree. I then put 70 cents into a bucket in which all 12 regions, including myself, share on a per capita basis. That's a different kind of economics than is prevalent or present on any other corporation. There's a revenue sharing thing that we have. And frankly, in studying the governor's tax packages and in studying the 246-page report on why things happen, I find very little relationship between the report and the tax bills which emerge. Section 7I, because it's a matter of contention on how money will be distributed, is also a matter of a court suit now, native against native. In that manner, I would like to say, as it relates to bookkeeping and a separate accounting system, is that the court's going to dictate, and the court shall determine how we shall account for Section 7I and its distribution, which will largely relate to, quote, income for native regional corporations. I'm not quite sure how it fits a separate accounting system, because we have, as you read the newspapers in the last few weeks, some of the regional corporations are in a very bad cash flow problem as it relates to profit or whatever. However, I think we could live with separate accounting. We don't have any place to hide. SEC requires that we give a standardized lawful report to our stockholders, and that's a matter of public record. It's on file with your Department of Commerce and your Department of Revenue. The courts are going to determine how we do the economics of Section 7I. I should rather imagine that some other things concern us much more. I see a bad effect on your proposed property tax as another stricture on the existence of the North Slope Borough. I see your franchise tax getting into areas that we have problems. And not problems very evident, Mr. Chairman, but crack. We fall into crack. Everybody tells me, Commissioner of Revenue, everybody else, hey, man, we're taking care of you. You guys are all right in this bill. I don't find it in the 246-page report. Neither do I find it in any of the bills that's presented right now. As a matter of fact, some of the amendments seem to work the other way around. Seems that because we're only Alaska corporations, that we're going to hurt a little more than anybody else. And I would say to this group that as a legislative finance group, the state of Alaska is the one governing entity in America, probably, bar none, that can plan a financial picture for at least 10 years, but can plan for some very strong citizen feelings that should become evident by next year, where you have the beginnings of the permanent funds, which ought to get up into the billions, concurrent with the probably going to be the highest unemployment rate for A-card union members in the last. There's some strange things happening to the state that need to be looked at and planned for. I don't think anybody can quarrel with the matter of taxation. It's a fact of life. The problem that we see is that every year the rules seem to change. The lands that we're working now are on what's called interim conveyance. We don't even have a title. They're just lands that the federal government has said, yeah, you're going to own eventually, and if you want to look for oil, go ahead. And while we're waiting for conveyance, the rules every year seem to change about how that ownership pattern shall be taxed. And I think, Mr. Chairman, that there is a void in government, and it appears to be not the ability to tax, but the ability to plan for how that tax money shall be spent. We would like to address this committee in that manner. It's more concerned to me about what's going to happen when you have your billion, as opposed to what, how you're going to get it. Eventually you're going to get it. That crude oil base is going to be there for 22 years. That pipeline is going to be filled by other oil wells that get developed in this